Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, straight from New York. And joining me today on the podcast are my colleagues, Diplomat Associate Editors Prashant Parameshwaran and Franz Stefan Gatti. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys.
Yep, thanks for
Glad
having us.
Glad to be here.
Absolutely. And I'm really looking forward to this podcast because the three of us will be devoting the next 20 or so minutes to discussing U.S. President Barack Obama's recent trip to India. As you might have read over at The Diplomat, Obama's trip to India is historic in a number of ways. Firstly, Obama is the first sitting U.S. president to visit India twice during his term as president, a surprising statistic you'd imagine, given that the United States and India do profess to have close economic relations, but it turns out that no other president apart from Obama has really done that. Secondly, Obama was the first U.S. president to be invited to India as the chief guest for India's Republic Day celebrations. Republic Day is a big deal in India. It marks the day independent India finally adopted a constitution and became a republic. And particularly, the Republic Day celebrations in New Delhi carry quite a bit of symbolism because, and I remember going to these when I was growing up and living in India. It was something that, you know, you just kind of do if you live in New Delhi. Basically, the Republic Day parades in India involve a huge show of India's military might and economic military hardware. In fact, there's a parade in one of the most famous streets in New Delhi called Rajpath, which is, you know, otherwise known as the King's Path. And it's a huge parade where India essentially parades everything from its infantry to its newest ICBMs. And to have the U.S. president sitting there with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi by him, watching this, you know, display of Indian military bravado, that sends a signal across the region, particularly to China. But anyways, we're going to talk about, obviously, the military and economic cooperation aspects of the U.S.-India relationship, particularly because we have Franz and Prashant here who are experts on those topics. But also, I just want to discuss, just to start off, a couple of the more important breakthroughs as a result of this trip to India by the U.S. president. The first is climate change, where India has usually been a difficult country on the issue of climate change in the sense that, you know, why should India's position has essentially been that developing countries that came to the development party late shouldn't have to pay the price of industrialized nations when it comes to capping emissions. However, based on statements made by Modi during this visit and a joint document on climate change released by two sides, it looks like India is finally coming around and willing to make some concessions. Now, this is, you know, you can contrast this with the U.S.-China agreement late last year where China agreed to emissions caps. Now, the India-U.S. agreement isn't really to that extent yet because India actually hasn't agreed to any specific emissions caps yet, but it's a positive sign that India is finally coming around and will have a international climate deal become more likely later in the year. And the second issue that is a major breakthrough is on civil nuclear commerce. The issue here was that in 2010, India passed a particularly heavy-handed piece of legislation on liability for civil nuclear suppliers and operators. This legislation ended up exposing any interested foreign companies that wanted to come into India and establish nuclear power plants to basically unlimited amounts of liability in the case of an accident. And this actually grew particularly worse after the Fukushima Daiichi incident in Japan, which raised a global panic about the safety of nuclear operators and nuclear power plants in general. Now, the unusual part of this legislation was that not only were the operators of these plants liable in the case of accidents, but the suppliers of nuclear equipment and reactor equipment were also liable, which was quite unusual and essentially meant that no major U.S. suppliers ended up setting up operations in India. Again, during this past visit, the United States and India worked out a sort of insurance pooling agreement where the Indian government will take a bit of the risk premium away from those foreign firms. And additionally, the unlimited liability issues, India will issue a memorandum of law, which will help U.S. firms assess their risk better and hopefully come into the country to establish nuclear commerce under the terms of the U.S.-India nuclear agreement. So Prashant and Franz, let's start talking about the climate change deal. Do you guys think that this development is going to end up bringing India around to a true international climate regime, or is this simply, again, wishful thinking?
Well, let me start by saying, I mean, I think I agree with you in the sense that it's really important to distinguish this with the agreement that was reached with China last year. Mm-hmm. Because essentially, the agreement that was reached between the U.S. and China was one where the Chinese agreed to gradually peak their emissions by 2030. So here in the U.S.-India agreement, there's no real agreement to peak emissions within a given year or by a specific level. I mean, what you do have is, and I think that both sides attempted to do this, is sort of a hodgepodge of different measures. So the Indians have announced things like, you know, they're going to do more things in terms of solar. The Americans have announced various partnerships to assist India in clean energy projects and renewables. So you have a lot of these different agreements, but I think the broad brush would be to say that, you know, it's fair to say that they failed to reach a major agreement in terms of, you know, reaching a similar agreement with along the lines of China, which I think has broader implications for the global climate regime going into this year. I think the two sides said that they were, you know, going to work towards a deal in Paris this year. But, you know, as most people who do climate negotiations know, a lot of the heavy lifting tends to be done domestically. A lot of the international climate negotiations either are deadlocked or you see very incremental gains being made. And in the end, it turns out that, you know, it's up to the individual countries to then enforce their own policies at home. So it remains to be seen exactly what effect this will have on India's behavior going forward.
Yeah, and I can definitely see there being a good deal of domestic resistance to the initiative, particularly because, you know, let's talk about this issue just in terms of U.S.-India ties more generally. I mean, there's always been this sort of strain in Indian politics, you know, be it the Congress Party, be it the BJP, there's always this latent skepticism towards the intentions of the United States in bilateral interactions with India. And that's always kind of been, you know, the case, particularly because, you know, it's due to a variety of issues, going back all the way to the Cold War, to the United States alliance with Pakistan. Essentially, you know, the United States has never really been seen as a trustworthy partner for India. And again, with these climate change talks, you know, Indians are going to be asking themselves, you know, is this in India's best interest, or is this simply something that, you know, the Modi government is agreeing to as a tit for tat with the United States in exchange for, you know, support in other areas? And I think, you know, we're going to start seeing that come up in the Indian domestic political debate as India moves towards implementation on the climate change issue. So I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're definitely going to see that, and I think you're right to point that out, because, you know, not only are there historical issues, there are also it comes down to a question of status and power, because you know, the United States is a developed country, and India is still a developing country. It's a rising power, but it's still very much a developing country. And I think even though Obama and Modi didn't really reach a, you know, far-reaching agreement on climate, I do think that both sides attempted to acknowledge that despite their differing status, they both need to have some give and take when it comes to resolving the actual problem. So, you know, Obama said in his statement, yes, you know, I acknowledge that the United States is a developing country and we need to do more, but if we don't all work together, we're not going to address this climate problem. And then Modi, in some of his talking points, said, you know, we acknowledge the fact that we need to do something, not because we're being pressured to have a similar agreement with China, but because we recognize that climate change is something that's going to affect our children and our grandchildren. So we need to make an effort to resolve this problem. So, you know, again, a lot of rhetoric, not much in terms of an agreement, but I still think it's significant that both sides said those things, because otherwise it could lead to domestic reactions that are negative, which is prone to happen in U.S.-India relations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's just, you know, move on real quick and talk about, you know, something that's very interesting to us here at The Diplomat, which is the defense aspect of the recent visit. Now, going back to Modi's visit in September 2014, there was a lot of talk around the U.S.-India Defense Technology and Trade Initiative, the DTTI, and essentially, during this recent visit, the United States and India extended their defense cooperation framework of 2005 by another 10 years, which will, and also they signaled that they'll both be working towards, you know, co-production, which is a big interest on the Indian side. Particularly, it's part of, you know, the Modi government's new Make in India initiative to indigenize defense production, bring India more into the fold as a defense industrial nation, as opposed to simply a defense importer. India is the largest weapons importer in the world, and the Modi government wants to change that ever so slightly to make India more self-sufficient when it comes to defense co-production. And the United States and India, they will be exploring co-production in the areas of aircraft carrier technology and several other areas. So Prashant, you wrote a piece before this visit covering the defense aspects, and you know, after the visit, what's your take? Are we seeing good progress on U.S.-India defense cooperation, or is this again going to be a lot of rhetoric followed by little action?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that. I mean, you know, based on the piece, I wrote, you know, a couple of things that I was hoping that both sides could achieve, and I think it's fair to say this was a year for both sides to sort of save the U.S.-India defense relationship. They had, you know, initially had the DTTI, as you pointed out, that was supposed to advance co-production and co-development, but none of the projects actually took off because there were differences about which projects to advance. And for some people, I mean, they were actually calling it a make or break year for the DTTI. So the fact that both sides were able to agree on, you know, a few specific projects going forward is already significant, even though those projects, you know, may not be that significant in and of themselves. And I think, you know, the administrative stuff, like the, you know, finalizing a new 10-year agreement, that's significant because the last agreement was signed in 2005 and a new agreement was supposed to be negotiated by this year. So I think these may seem like housekeeping items or administrative items, but I think very much they helped rescue a relationship which was seen as lagging over the last few years, because there was a lot of initial promise about U.S.-India defense cooperation. And so in some ways, the promise is, you know, now being lived up to in terms of the actual reality. So.
And Franz, what's your take on, you know, the the speed and scope of defense cooperation between these two countries?
Yes, I'm still very skeptical, in my opinion. I just don't think that we will see much progress in this field. One of the reasons being that India is just not very high in the Obama White House foreign policy agenda, despite the rhetoric. I think, you know, in times of budgetary cuts, I just find it very difficult to think that, you know, this will really lead to any substantial changes in the mill-to-mill relations between the two countries. And maybe you want to bear with me for just one second. It just occurred to me this morning, since you both know that I often like to work with historical analogies, because I feel like maybe it's a good thing that the United States and India are not cooperating as closely in defense issues. You know, as they could. Maybe the United States should sort of, you know, heed the maxim, be careful what you wish for, because maybe closer military and diplomatic ties between India and the United States may actually embolden India's foreign policy, which could potentially destabilize the South Asia region. I know that's a bit far-fetched, but maybe you can just bear with me for one more minute. I was thinking about that because I feel like, you know, India always positioned itself as a bridging power somewhere between the United States and China, and that made me think of European history in the 19th and early 20th century and the Austrian Empire. And because the Austrian Empire, like India, was considered to be a bridging power between East and West for much of its existence. And there are a couple of other similarities. It was a multinational empire, more concerned with its internal security and stability than with great power politics. And it also suffered humiliating defeats, for example, in 1859 and 1866, reluctant to use military power to achieve its political objectives. And, you know, India had a similar issue after, for example, the Sino-Indian War in 1960. too, and these, you know, defeats that India suffered over time also led to various military and political reforms, and also another similarity to Austria-Hungary is that India is also being held together by a you know, slightly inefficient but omnipotent bureaucracy. Now that's of course just the domestic side, but I think what's most interesting to me is that just, you know, this alliance that Austria entered with Germany emboldened Austria during the late 19th century and early 20th century in its stance vis-a-vis Serbia. And maybe if it's a bit far-fetched, you can maybe substitute Serbia with Pakistan, and then you can see that, you know, this could potentially lead to some trouble. And I think they're also facing, you know, very similar problems. A powerful peer competitor in the East conducting a relatively subtle anti-Indian South Asian policy, and a smaller but much more real subversive threat coming from Pakistan, and also on top of that, continuing internal unrest. And so if you add the world's strongest military power to this mix, that is the United States, perhaps, you know, the results could be a bit explosive. I don't know whether you guys would agree. That's just my, like, a, you know, my interpretation at the moment. So maybe it's actually good. And I think, you know, 2 years ago, I believe it was, the former Indian Foreign Secretary, Kanwal Sibal, said about U.S.-India relations that, you know, he said, India and the United States will neither enter into an embrace nor disengage. They will just continue to shake friendly hands. And I believe this will be true in the next year. And I think that's a good thing from all that I've just have said.
Yeah. No, you just brought up a bunch of interesting issues that I'd love to talk about for, you know, at least a couple hours, but I won't do that for our listeners. I mean, the first thing that I'd address is your statement that I completely agree with, that India has always sort of been a lower priority on, you know, the U.S. foreign policy totem pole. And I, you know, honestly, the part of the reason for that, I think, is since the end of the Cold War, India has sort of been taken for granted in Asia. You know, it's an Asian democracy. It's politically liberal. It's primarily focused on one security threat. I mean, obviously, in the late 1990s when India tested nuclear weapons, I think that kind of woke the United States up a bit and said, you know, it started to say, hey, okay, we really have to, you know, make sure that India doesn't become a proliferation risk and can, you know, come into the global nuclear regime effectively, which, you know, now, the, you know, that is the case. But anyways, I you know, I still think that, you know, India is kind of taken for granted. It's always sort of this, you know, regional power that the United States sees as perpetually present in the region, not particularly a threat to U.S. interests, but not also a huge boon to, you know, the U.S. rebalance to East Asia, except perhaps in recent years. I mean, also the problem is that, you know, while India has bipartisan support in the United States, you know, there's, you know, even though Obama's a lame duck president after last year's midterms, that didn't really affect his India visit and his ability to conclude deals, because Republicans, Democrats, everybody's in favor of closer cooperation between the two sides. But a result of that is that, you know, there aren't really polarizing opinions or any sort of impulses within the White House, you know, even within the previous Republican administration during the Bush administration, with the exception of the nuclear deal, to really move relations forward with India at a particularly fast pace. And, you know, going back to what I talked about in India about the latent sort of skepticism of U.S. intentions, it's really resulted in a situation where, as the former foreign secretary said, you know, the two countries have just been mired in this state of, you know, nice rhetoric, a lot of handshakes, but very little actual action and deliverance. Prashant, do you want to address the Austro-Hungarian example?
Well, I mean, I would say just broadly, I mean, I guess it is dangerous to be over-optimistic about U.S.-India relations. I mean, it's always easier to be pessimistic. But I think you have seen India become more, relatively more of a U.S. priority over the last couple of years, particularly under the Obama administration, I think. And it's interesting that, you know, if you look back a few years later and a few years before, I mean, the Obama administration, I mean, you're right in the sense that he is a lame duck president and he's going out next year. But in this visit, I think he has basically concluded a number of specific agreements. You know, the breakthrough on the civil nuclear issue is a huge deal. I mean, it's a significant breakthrough. the fact that they were able to agree on DTTI, and also the symbolic idea of going and attending India's Republic Day. I mean, these things are they may not be groundbreaking historically, but I think they're pretty important in the U.S.-India relationship more generally. And I think I definitely agree with France and also yourself that, you know, there's not a really urgent need to be cautious about too much U.S.-India cooperation, specifically because there are so many constraints to that. And I think what you can hope for, and I think what we should be hoping for realistically, is enough cooperation such that the bureaucrats on both sides and the populations on both sides in both countries can advance the relationship incrementally over time. And I think you have little spurts of energy followed by some lethargy following that. But I think this is definitely one of those periods where there's been an injection of momentum in the relationship. So,
yeah. Well, I think just one thing that I really would like to emphasize again is here also that when we talk about India, we really have to focus about on the Indian bureaucracy, because I feel like that's the center of power in India in so many ways. And from my past experience dealing with Indian policymakers, you know, politicians may decide or may agree on something, and it's just the implementation which is always the problem. And I think time and again we have seen this also with U.S. India-U.S. defense deals and cooperation. It's just very often that the Indian side just can't deliver. I think that's also one of the reasons why the United States has sort of assumed this hands-off approach on a number of issues.
I agree with you, France, on the defense issue and the bureaucracy. And I myself are very skeptical about implementation, particularly when it comes to U.S.-India relations. But I do think, relatively speaking, I think we can see some improvement. So the former defense minister in India, A.K. Antony, was a huge obstructionist in terms of advancing U.S.-India defense relations. His successor now, Manohar Parrikar, is much more welcoming in that regard. And that's why you're seeing a little bit more progress in that regard. And then, secondly, I do agree with you that a lot of this will come down to domestic politics in India. And I think even there you saw, for example, recently the firing of the head of the DRDO, which is, infamous in India for not helping advance defense industry in India. So these developments are small, but, I wouldn't discount the Indian bureaucracy just yet, particularly since Modi has just taken office. So there might be some energy there that we're just not seeing.
Yeah, that's a really good point about the defense ministry. In my experience, observing the Indian defense ministry for some years, it seems like it's a highly centralized ministry. I mean, just specifically the defense ministry. I mean, other parts of the Indian bureaucracy, notably maybe the foreign ministry and other areas, are less so and more dependent on sort of individual departments. But the defense ministry, at least under A.K. Antony, was highly centralized under his leadership. And that actually resulted in a poor state of affairs for the overall procurement and bilateral cooperation process with the United States. Anyways, guys, thanks a lot for joining me on the podcast. This is certainly, a continuous topic of discussion for us here at The Diplomat. I think we, touched on some interesting topics, and it'd be good to come back another week and pick them up.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you.